This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Ross Kessels,
Andrew Stevens,
and Vicky Marie Buchanan. So Ross, we've talked a lot about your experiences in Forestry Service and DOC. You left DOC. Tell us a little bit about that and what happened then.
Well, I'd only been with DOC, it was less than 3 years, and then the government restructured it. Basically, the district that I had was going to disappear, along with my job, and I could have taken a lower job, but as I saw it then, my career was going to go backwards 5 to 10 years, and I'd lived overseas in Botswana as a young boy, as a teenager. And I had a taste for, I wanted to do overseas work again. And Massey had started up a new development studies program, a postgraduate program there. And I was very interested in that. So I decided to take redundancy when the district disappeared, which was pretty sad actually. Took a punt and went off to uni to be a student again.
Ooh, that would be hard work.
It was actually. It was a bit humbling. It was funny because in DOC, District Conservator, I was in the media a lot, you know, and you had a profile. But that, I think that was the end of November I left, and the university didn't start till the beginning of March. So I went on the dole for 3 months. Now that was character building.
Yes.
From being district conservator one day, and I think the dole office was also on Queen Street. So a day or so later, I walked down a couple of doors down the road and joined the dole queue.
Sobering.
So, but anyway, that tided me over till I started uni, where I was still eligible for student allowance for a year. And I became a student again, which is also character building. And I changed from, basically, my forestry science degree was natural science and economics and so forth. And development studies was social science. So that was
quite a different way of thinking, a transition.
Yeah. So we went from one camp to the other. And I remember some pretty heated discussions at one lecture where I was... didn't agree with what I was being taught. But it was very interesting actually doing that transition, because, you know, often there's a polarisation between scientific view and social science view, and neither twain do meet. But, you know, that was good, because there's a different way of looking at the sometimes the same problem. And if you're managing a forest, you know, the forests and the trees are easy, but it's the people that are the tricky stuff. And, you know, I remember some fairly lively meetings in Forest Service, public meetings, but development studies was good, because for me, probably the most interesting bit was sociology. So that you know, that was a very useful tool, as it turned out. But... I spent a year doing papers, you know, back in exams again, and then I had to do a thesis, and preferably in a developing country, because you're doing development studies. And I put in for a job in Solomon Islands, a forestry job, which I didn't get. A friend got there. Also, Dad had been in Solomon Islands in the war of the New Zealand Navy up there, so knew about Solomon's. Dad had always talked about it, and I'd done my homework on this job. So I decided to go up to Solomon Islands and do my field work, and the a couple of friends were there. The one who'd got that job, he was there, and had another friend working up there. So they were very good to me in that they helped me set up a field location up there. And the first one didn't work out, but long and short I ended up on the island of Choiseul, right up near Bougainville, living in a village. Obviously the only European there, and I lived in a leaf house for over 4 months, sort of doing research there.
So just pause a little bit and tell us about that. You're living in a leaf house, which is, explain the leaf house.
A leaf house is, think of a Maori wari, mm-hmm. the old type right. that were made mm-hmm. with maybe flax mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. whatever in New Zealand, with, you know, poles tied together with vines. Mm-hmm. And a leaf house in Solomon Islands is like that,
right.
except the cladding on the walls and the roof is sago palm, which is like a bigger version of our flax.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, there's a whole technique mm-hmm. for doing
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But to backtrack a bit, I set up a research, you know, in forestry it was always difficult to put a value on the non-timber uses of a forest, you know, like recreation mm. or wildlife habitat mm. Or whatever, or just beauty,
mm.
you know.
Mm.
So that stuck with me, and I talked with Foreign Affairs. I was trying to get some funding from them. And it was suggested that I look at the subsistence value of the rainforest in Solomon Islands, which were being badly logged at that time by Malaysian logging companies primarily. And through my studies, I'd studied a lot about that. But the Solomon Islanders, the rural villagers, depended very much on the forests for their livelihood, just like Māori 100+ years ago in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So I thought, and the forests were being raped and pillaged metaphorically through logging. So I thought, I want to know what this, what impact this is having. And so I had the idea of developing a technique to put a monetary value on the subsistence value of the forest and compare that with logging royalties to see which was most valuable for Solomon Islanders. And Solomon Islanders, you know, they were at the time a subsistence economy, but, you know, they wanted the things that we wanted. They wanted to give their kids an education. They got a lot of food from the forest, but they also wanted, you know, other food, rice, very basic needs by our standards. So they had a need for cash. So the only way they could really generate cash was by logging their forests.
Did they think about what impact that would have on their food base or anything like livelihood?
They often didn't fully appreciate what logging meant, because it always had the forest, it had always been there. And it's like we were talking about the other day, you know, when a forest goes, it disappears and it's awful. But but what I did, I went up there, stayed in Honiara with my friends and accumulated enough food and equipment to take up to Choiseul to last me about 4 months.
Right.
And I'd gone somewhere else in the meantime, but to arrange a permit with Western Province. What I did was I had to go up by ship, and from Honiara up to Choiseul Bay, and Choiseul was about a 3-day journey.
Wow.
And I clapped out little wee cargo boat that had been a fishing boat that had been donated to Solomon Islands by Japan, and I was deck cargo. There were no cabins.
So 3 days.
I went with a great pile of equipment and sat on the deck and you know, it was quite a culture shock. But the Solomon Islanders were lovely. They, you know, they talked to you and they kind of looked out for you. And we went up to Choiseul, and that was, you know, pretty big culture shock. And
unpack that a little bit. Why? How?
Well, I was in a completely different culture. I didn't speak pidgin at the time.
Right.
I didn't speak the local languages. Solomon Islanders, you know, a lot spoke English, but I had to learn pidgin in a hurry.
Was that a big problem for you?
Pidgin, it's a sort of broken English,
yes.
You know. Suppose me story long, you long pidgin, and close up a little bit long English. So, you know, if I talk to you in pidgin, it's a little bit like English.
Mm.
But, yeah, but anyway, I went up there by boat, and we went up through the Russell Islands, where Dad was stationed in the war, into...
That must have been moving.
Yandina, and I remember seeing a couple of, you know, humpback whales there. Then from Russell Islands, we went up... oh, hang on, sorry, that was a different trip. Yeah, Choiseul, we went just straight up past Isabel. And no, hang on, we went through, just trying to think. Yeah, we went up past Isabel there to get up to Solomon Islands, up to Choiseul. And yeah, so there was quite a long period in, you know, open sea, really. And followed the Isabel coast up until we came to Choiseul. And, you know, Choiseul was about 90 miles long, just bush. And I remember going through a sort of inland passage. We went past Sasamunga, which was the old mission station had been there. We didn't go ashore there. And then got up to Choiseul Bay. And we moored at Choiseul Bay. You know, this would be the third night, I think, on the other side of the bay, because the administrative centre, the little ex-colonial administrative centre, was on Taro Island, which was infested with mosquitoes. So next day we went across to, we moored in Choiseul Bay, and the next day went across to Taro Island, but the captain hadn't come back to the ship because he'd gone ashore to be with his wife. So first mate took the ship across to Taro, and me and my gear were dumped on this broken down concrete wharf, and I had a contact, Billy Savavai, so I put the word out to try and find Billy, and Billy was located, and he took me to his house, and I think they'd heard that I was coming, but I'm not quite sure.
So the communication obviously was not cell phones.
Oh, nothing like that. No, the word got around in Solomon Islands. They had what they call the coconut telegraph, which was word of mouth, and it was extremely efficient, I have to say. And anyway, Billy and his wife Nellie, they hit a house because he was the airline agent there, and it was actually what they call a house made of permanent material, which was fibrolite and corrugated iron. And I sort of was given a mattress on the floor in a room and basically tried to pretend and have a sleep, but of course I couldn't. But anyway, I waited, and Billy turned up, and he loaded me and my gear into his boat, and we went down the coast to Nukiki village, and I arrived, and there was someone in Honiara had made available her leaf house. She worked for a research station there, Ruth Lilagula, and Billy was her brother. So
there's that whole sort of network.
Yeah, they set me up in the village, and I think next day Solomon and someone else came along. He was one of the village elders, and they checked me out and found out what I was doing. I don't know whether they knew I was coming, but, you know, Solomon Islanders are very adaptable.
Yeah, they heard about this white man in the village.
Well, everyone heard about this white man that had turned up in the village. I was number one curiosity. So I sort of had to sort of set up and learn pidgin in a hurry. And I had a research program, and bit by bit we got into that. And they very generously showed me their way of life, and it ended up, not only was there superb information I got out of that, but it was a life-changing experience, really, where I became embedded in their village and learned so much about their culture and developed a huge respect for their knowledge of the natural world. I mean, I thought I knew, being a forester, being a dock conservator, I thought I had a pretty good grasp of the natural world. But exactly. But their knowledge was superb. Yeah. They didn't differentiate between the marine environment and the land environment. You know, it was all part of their natural habitat, really. But they taught me how they used the forest. And it was very much like the old Maori way of life. You know, their use of the forest, their customs, their stories paralleled very much, you know, with the old Maori way of life. And that was, you know, that was very useful when I came back, actually. It gave me a great insight into Pacific culture.
And how did you manage with the mosquito side of things? Because it's pretty bad up there, isn't it?
Yeah, I slept under a mosquito net and was on, you know, malaria treatment. I did get it at a later stage, but not there. But basically, the methodology was to try and artificially put a monetary value on how they use the forest. And basically the methodology was that if you couldn't get the free goods from the forest, like food via garden sites in there, fruit, you know, timber for building leaf houses, logs for making dugout canoes, medicine, trees and all that, if you couldn't get that stuff, what would it cost to substitute it with goods available through the marketplace, you know?
Good question, isn't it, really?
So I was able to sort of use what they called surrogate values, and that you could apply that to pretty much, you know, all the uses of the forest except the medicine one. And the medicine, I think I used a travel cost approach there, where there was a clinic at Taro Island about 5 miles away. So to get the medicine was free there, but they would have to go by canoe, and there was a cost of petrol. So, you know, that was a bit, but the long and short of it was that, you know, for a similar piece of land, the timber royalties they would get from it, you know, would be quite small. The subsistence value of that same piece of forest would be 50 times greater, for example. So really the subsistence use of the forest was of far more value to them than the timber value.
Have they learnt that as a nation? I mean, it's quite sad, isn't it, to think that they've given their forest away or sold their forest away to, at that time, a Malaysian logging company. Fast track, because that was back, when was that, in the
19... That was 1991,
when I did that. So now, in 2020, what's happened?
Well, I mean, logging's been pretty bad throughout Solomons, and they've been ripped off hugely, but funnily enough, I went back to Nukiki Village in 2012 to do more research, looking at the village governance and comparing that with the Westminster system. And after holding out for about almost 20 years, they had logged. They were logging when I was there. They were quite apologetic about it, knowing my earlier views, but it didn't worry me. But it had been, you know, a lot of angst in coming to that decision, but they did use a lot of those logging royalties for upgrading the school, You know, they, when I was there, that the school was a ramshackle little leaf house building with, and now they had nice, you know, timber buildings, and they built a clinic and all that, and put money towards other projects and distributed funds, you know, throughout the village to all villages. I mean, so they'd done it quite fairly, which often is not the case in Solomon's. You know, a lot of communities, the chief might capture the money, and you know.
So, do you think for their life, too, it hasn't sold? What I want to say is sold their soul or sold their way of life. It hasn't had that negative effect on their life. It's more had a positive effect, like the buildings for schools and things.
I can really only speak for Nukiki Village. I think other communities have had quite negative experiences. I think they managed it quite well, really. There are other problems that have overtaken that, like, you know, sea level rise. They're very aware of that, and that's hugely serious for them. Population growth, you know, that's a big issue. Monetization of other resources, the cash economy has really taken hold a lot more, which is not a bad thing, but it creates different sort of pressures within the community.
It's probably a foregone conclusion that they needed to sell that timber anyway to survive or progress.
I think they used it quite wisely. It was a resource that was there. The tragedy when I did the earlier research was many communities were getting ripped off and squandering, and it was a one-off resource that they had. And even one of the logging companies, it was a Korean one, the guy, he was a good guy doing the logging, he said, oh, look, basically saying that they had this resource and, you know, communities were wasting it. But Nukiki Village, I think, handled it quite wisely, and they did use it as a stepping stone up to get their kids' education. And really, education is the way up. You know, when I was first there, they were lucky if one kid in the whole village made it through to secondary school. Whereas this time, you know, there were several who had gone to university, and most were going to the you know, the lower secondary schools, community colleges, I think they called that. That was up to our what's the old fifth form
year 11
and some went through to, you know, year 12 and 13 at a sort of provincial secondary school. So things had changed a lot, and education level was coming up, which was really, really good.
Was the island very large that you're on?
It was about 90 miles long, Choiseul. But, you know, there's chains of islands in Solomon Islands. There's lots of islands there.
Yeah.
And that was one of the bigger ones.
You said you felt very enriched and humbled. What was one thing, just to close, what was one thing that will stay in your heart always about your experience there?
To be accepted in their community, really, and to understand the different way of looking at things, a different way of thinking, and that's where the sociology really helped.
Sociology too.
I remember one guy said, basically, you're right, you're white on the outside, but you're black on the inside.
Oh, what a huge compliment. Huge compliment. Thank you. What an amazing experience. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.